So, Layla, I want to thank you for joining me again. I remember we had our first conversation almost a year ago, and I'm really happy that we've been keeping in contact. And your analysis has really been invaluable for so many different topics. And I asked you to speak with me today because right now, as you know, there's a another flare up happening in the United States with racism, with prejudice, with this Trayvon Martin incident in Florida. And like we were just saying before we started the interview, it's bringing people down. It's depressing to have to talk about these things, but we have to try to figure out a way to talk about them in a different way, in a way that helps us heal ourselves and hopefully show people that this racism, this prejudice, this white supremacy that exists is it's a part of our, it's a deeper part of society. It's something that's been existing for a long time. And I think that your analysis of civilization in general will help us, unpack all of these issues. So I think first for people who may not know who you are, maybe you could give like a brief introduction of who you are and, your work and what you're doing in Canada and stuff like that.
Yeah, thank you, Ron. It's actually always a great pleasure to talk with you, on the record or off the
Right.
record. So, right now, well, I always find it difficult to introduce myself because there's so little time and I don't see myself in any particular category. I'm a human animal living in occupied Canada
Right.
and trying to learn about this world and share what I learn with the world. I'm also a mother, a friend, and well, yeah, a
Okay.
cosmic citizen.
And that's basically the most important thing, what you just described. I mean, a lot of people go into their credentials and stuff like that, but I don't really find that to be important, honestly. And but I think the first thing I'd like to talk about is something that you posted on Facebook yesterday that I found very interesting. It was this article talking about how people have a really hard time feeling empathy for those outside of their own ethnic groups. And I was wondering if we could talk about that and try to relate that to what's going on here in North America with all of the white supremacy and the racism and things like that. How did you find this article and what are your thoughts about it?
Well, actually, I don't remember. It was a while ago. Somebody posted it on Facebook, and I was busy going back and forth, and I don't remember if I reposted it or not. But recently, I went and looked at it again because this is a study conducted by University of Toronto, Scarborough, by Jennifer Gutzel and Michael Inslick. And yeah, they looked. The study is in 2010, and they looked at whether white people can the brain impulses, the neurological brain impulses, would be triggered in the same way when they see people of color conducting activities, and do they react, do they empathize with these activities in the same way as when they see people of the same race. I thought of it particularly in relationship with with an earlier study that was done on empathy between classes. And so it's really interesting. There are certain things in both studies. The other study was conducted by, it's also in 2010, Krauss and others, University of California in San Francisco, University of Toronto again, and Berkeley. And that was on empathy and class. Both are really interesting because they show that dominant groups do not empathize in the same way with dominated or dispossessed, disempowered groups. So in the Krauss study, Krauss et al. And company. It was the upper class, members of the upper class, regardless of ethnic or racial background, could not accurately read the emotions and feelings of people of lower class, whereas the lower class people could empathize and read the emotions accurately of everyone else. And in this case, it was they decided to look at the University of Toronto study. They just decided to look at the racial aspect of it. And both studies show the same thing. Okay, my own reservations would be with with the way they define empathy, and with the definition of empathy, then they would be looking for certain things that maybe perhaps if I were on board of that study, I would have expanded the definition to include not only reading of, it's sort of focused, it's, the study is conducted from a civilized perspective,
which means
that it focuses on your intellectual understanding or comprehension, and how it translates into your biology or physiology of other people's experiences. I would say from an anti-civilizational perspective, such understanding necessarily entails a much more organic understanding and response. So it's not only that you understand what the other feels, are you capable of feeling what the other feels? And the way that civilization divides and rules or divides and conquers necessarily for institutionalizing one class of ownership, you know, so the dominant class, and everyone else who will be ultimately consumed, whether in terms of resources, work resources, in terms of pleasure, you know, the part of the gender oppression is based on both production and reproduction of human resources as well as of obtainment of pleasure. And this pleasure then will be also characterized in a specific way. So all of these feelings would be then, and emotions and relationships will be read from that stance, whereas it is necessary for the survival of the oppressor not to feel what your victim feels.
Now, this is a really interesting concept because I think right now in our society, especially with President Obama being in office and, you know, people thinking that we're in some kind of, you know, multicultural golden age or something, this might be a little bit shocking for people to hear that, you know, it's the way our society functions is that the people who are in power are just not supposed to feel anything for those who are being oppressed. And I think from my own experience, you know, I grew up going to, you know, desegregated schools here in Philadelphia. And I also went to a school way out in the countryside of Pennsylvania called, it was called Milton Hershey. And it was basically, you know, a school for disadvantaged children, but it was mostly white kids there. And I was one of the only black kids. So my whole experience growing up has been around diversity, around different sorts of people other than myself. And so when I come into contact with people, you know, mostly white people, of course, who, you know, they look at me and I can tell just from our initial interaction that they're looking at me and they're not really seeing who I am. They're seeing some kind of, you know, representation in their mind of what I am or some kind of stereotype or something. But when I look at someone else, whether they're black, white, Chinese, it doesn't matter. I don't have that thing where I'm just looking at someone and seeing kind of like a stereotype. So is and this is very this is a very strange position for many people to be in our country, because minority people, because we're kind of taught to look at the dominant classes as people, but they're not taught to look at us as people. So we're constantly fighting that battle, you know.
Absolutely, and that's also part of the well, definitely the division of class, and especially in North America, across, well, race as a class that has been historically exploited, makes it so that even members of the same class but of white race will ultimately having that white privilege, which people still refuse to acknowledge, they would not, they will also, to preserve, almost like to preserve their own white privilege, even though they are the lowest in the category of the white class, they will also have to participate in the oppression of the lower resources, right? It's like the whole, well, the whole evolutionary idea of the food chain actually locks us in these categories even deeper, because we cannot, like, even if we try to talk and, like, say, that's why I cannot imagine that anytime soon we will be ridding ourselves of these classes and these racisms and speciesism and sexism and all these aggressions, because the whole concept underlying our narrative, how we perceive ourselves, we, all of us, are taught to perceive ourselves in a certain place in that food chain, and it's a hierarchical food chain. And today, since this whole notion and the narrative, the scientific narrative, was written very recently by white people, it puts the white man at the top of that food chain, then the white woman, then, you know, then da 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 da, and further down they, you know, goes to animals and others. There's actually a very an excellent talk. It's available on Vimeo by Nikisha Alexis Baker. It's called Speciesism, Racism, and Sexism Intertwined. And it illustrates perfectly how, you know, she takes how, for example, popular media advertisements, commercials on TV would ultimately use these categories, the underlying category of oppression, which is at the beginning was that the construction of humanism versus animals, so the degradation of animals comes first, and then you use that concept. She shows how you can then degrade and objectify and therefore use, exploit and abuse women and people of color. The whole, you know, slavery was based on the fact that Africans were not considered human. Even their depictions in the so-called scientific evolutionary textbook, you know, just a couple of hundred years ago, not such a long time ago, time of our grandparents, great-grandparents. My grandmother is still alive, you know, my Sudanese grandmother is still alive. So, you know, for me, it's kind of, it's very recent. And so, these things, like even how these tragedies, how the victims of oppression, in order to express their dismay, will have to use these metaphors of degrading someone else. For example, this horrible, you know, this horrible recent event in California with Shai Malawadi.
Yeah, the Iraqi woman who was killed.
Yes. I mean, it's totally tragic, and I totally feel and understand, the sense of loss and meaninglessness, and I don't have words to express that, for her daughters, her family, her friends, her neighbor, her community, right?
Yeah, she was for people who may not know, she was an Iraqi woman, basically American. She was an American she wore a head covering, but she wasn't walking around in a burqa or something. She was just like basically a typical average, Iraqi American woman who was a housewife. She had five kids. Someone one day broke into her house and essentially beat her within an inch of her life and left a note saying, "Go back to your country." And she died a few days later from her injuries. So,
yes. And when her daughter, is trying to express her grief and her feelings, totally legitimate grief, totally legitimate, feelings of dismay and, she nonetheless, refers to the people who did this. She's like, "They're animals. They're animals. Yeah. How could they do that?"
Yeah.
And so the narrative remains intact that to refer to those people as animals, you assume that the animals are degraded. But when you look at the studies of wilderness, animals would never do such a thing. It's precisely because those people are humans. It's precisely because they're civilized humans, they're not animals, that they're capable of going and doing something so brutal.
Exactly.
And in all the cases that we're going to discuss today, they're very interesting because they are kind of so honest and to your face, but at the same time, and they're horrendous, but focusing on the kind of on the pure victim hides the reality of the millions of people who go through this every day, but they will not be taken to represent the victimhood because, well, maybe someone was taking drugs, maybe someone stole something from a store. To me, that does not qualify anyone, for execution.
Exactly.
And nonetheless, the way the narrative frames it is that you can have pure victims and then you can have the non-pure victims. But if everybody agrees in that civilized narrative itself, then you basically perpetuate the need for tragedy and the need to eliminate some and preserve the rights and advantages and privileges totally stolen at the expense of those same victims, of others, of the oppressors.
Right. It's like saying that some people were, asking for it somehow or they deserved it or something like that, which
exactly.
is kind of bizarre. And, let's talk about a few of these cases, the ones I emailed to you earlier. This one, the first one is really, really just unbelievable. It was in St. Louis, Missouri. And the title of the article is "Woman Dies After Being Dragged from Hospital." So just for people who may not be aware of this situation, this is about a woman named Anna Brown, who was 29 years old, who went to a hospital in St. Louis complaining of pain in her ankle. She said that she sprained her ankle or something, and she was having a hard time walking, and she was in a lot of pain. The hospital staff, as most hospitals are in this country, their people are overworked or whatever. She wasn't paid attention to, for a long time. She was sitting there waiting. Eventually the doctors did come and examine her and they determined that nothing was wrong with her and that she should just leave. She refused to leave because she said that she was in too much pain to stand. So the police were brought into the situation and she was basically carried out of the hospital in excruciating pain. Put in handcuffs, taken to a police car. There's a video of her sitting in the back of the police car and the police officer is saying, "We need you to get out of the police car." And she's saying, "I can't stand up because I can't walk. I'm in too much pain." So they carry her out of the police car into a jail cell. They don't even lay her on the bed. They lay her on the fucking floor and she's in there on the floor writhing in pain and moaning. And this is all on videotape. This is, of course, a black woman, and she's laying on the floor, moaning in pain. Half an hour later, she dies because of the blood clots in her ankle travel to her lungs. On this video, the police are seen talking amongst themselves in the jail cell. They're cleaning it out or something. And they say, oh, she was just in here half an hour ago. And one of them is like, oh, well. And to me, that was the most shocking thing about this, even more so than her ordeal. Just they're, oh, well, you know.
And not only, oh, well, I mean, he had, the other ones asked him, so why wasn't she taken to the hospital? I said, oh, we thought she was, what was it?
Drug sick? Yeah.
Yeah, she was drug sick.
Oh, yeah.
So, and then, of course, they, and then the first thing they do is they test for drugs, and she doesn't have any.
Right.
But supposedly she had.
Of course. I mean, this is about the empathy we were talking about. They look at her as a black woman, and what do they see? Yeah, so I guess we're going to talk about these two cases all together. The second one is, this is from North Carolina. So on the other side of the country, this is, but within the same time frame, basically both of these were reported on the same day, March 26, a few days ago. Husband and wife shot as children watch. So this is in North Carolina. A guy is, this man is shooting his gun, his shotgun, for who knows why. This guy comes out of his house and says, can you please stop shooting your gun? You know, you're disturbing my family. So I'm just going to read a little bit from the article what happened. Neighbors said that 35-year-old Tommy Brown was playing basketball with his sons and was concerned because neighbor John Oliver Hill Jr. was shooting a gun in the area. So, and there's a quote from someone, and this nut comes from across the street who had been outside shooting his gun. The gentleman asked him if he would quit it because of all the kids outside. So he took it upon himself to come over here, and he just shot the man, shot him in the head, said neighbor Lois Claremont. So then, not only did he shoot the man, when the wife comes out to hear, I guess after she heard the gunshot, this man shoots the woman twice and kills her right in front of the kids. So this person was arrested, thank God. I mean, maybe it's a miracle he was even charged for anything, but he was arrested and taken into custody. But now we have two children who have no mother and no father because someone just shot them for no reason in front of their house. So these two stories on top of the Trayvon Martin incident, it's painting a very, very ugly picture of what is going on. And for me, I can just say personally, I'm just like beyond enraged right now with what's going on. It's just difficult to even think about it. But Layla, what are your thoughts on this? And how can we think about this in a way where we don't get paralyzed by rage and paralyzed by fear? I think some people might even be afraid to go out and do things now because they think that, maybe rightly so, black people are really under attack in this country.
It's very difficult. It is very difficult to not feel that, and it's a normal. Our normal animal reaction is to feel the pain, to feel the fear. I mean, just to have a little. Excursion to the observations on animals, rats, for example, in the laboratory, several studies, Rutten Taborski, 2007, Beckhoff and Pierce, 2009, and others, show that, a rat who doesn't even know the other rat, so it's not even an acquaintance will not take food because they put these triggers that if she takes food, the other one will get an electric shock. So the rat will not take food. The rat is capable of altruism and giving the food to the other rat so she would not receive the electric shock.
Wow.
And these are incredible, like you hear Goethe talking about Eckermann observing how, you know, interspecies adoption in the wild, you know, the, you know, if some birds, one species birds, parents perish, another species would raise them. You hear, you know, all of this, and you hear it in wild humans, in wild humans whose communities are governed by mutual aid, biodiversity, and empathy. It still exists. And it's only in these divided societies, the civilized societies, hierarchical, pyramidal, that you find this, not only, it's not even about apathy or the lack of empathy. It's actually about cruelty. That you're not only willing to ignore the pain of the other, you're not capable of understanding, feeling, empathizing with that pain, but you're actually willing to cause it and willing to close your eyes to guard your, to safeguard your own privileges and material goods and symbolic capital. You close your eyes, and this is what's happening in all of these cases, on someone else who does the job for you. The case of the hospital and this these three cases are slightly different. Well, in their slightly, they are different in the way their narrative or contexts are framed. But definitely, I mean, they all draw from the same ontological premises. So, like, if we start with the first case with Anna Brown, you know, in the hospital. I mean, you look at the history of hospitals and medical institutions. First of all, again, you know, ontologically, in diverse, rich communities, healthy communities, every person is human or non-human person is expected to be able to live in the world, learn how to live in the world, and learn and live in a way that will safeguard the, you know, the community, the livelihood, the land base, you know, with all the life around it.
Right.
So when you get, so that's the non-civilized societies and communities. If somebody gets ill, the whole concept of illness is not, it's not illness. You know, you do not feel well. You kind of fall out of harmony with your own rhythm, with your own body, or with the body of that community you're in. And then you find a way, and the community of life around you helps you to reintegrate back into that balance, into that harmony. Be it through just, you know, rest or movement, nomadism, you know, you find rotation of food, herbs, you know, even, you know, friendship with animals will help you find that healing. So the healing happens organically for everyone. Everyone participates in it, and most of all, the person herself knows whether she's well or not well, and she looks autonomously for ways to find that community to help her heal. When you, the first thing in civilization is, apart from the fact that the hierarchy and the poverty, the disempowerment, creates a lot of malnourishment, stress, and diseases, contagious diseases, because, you know, everybody is living in small cramped spaces. And apart from that, you find the war on witches. So there's a study by Jane Usher. Then, of course, there's in more recent times, well, there's Usher and Michel Foucault. But even Peter Kropotkin, the Russian anarchist, turn of the 20th century, mostly 19th century. He's already talked about the hospital, the role of the hospital to confine the stranger, to confine, and actually not only confine, it's quarantine. To quarantine means to separate the disordered or disorderous elements from the rest of the ordered society that you're going to utilize as your resources. Okay, so quarantine is you lock them up so they will not be in touch with the rest, they will not be contagious. And Peter Kropotkin said it's the first people are the vagabonds and the so-called mentally ill, who will be defined as mentally ill because they will not conform to that totalitarian order. And the hospital will try to either recycle them into that order to be used. Then you have the whole terminology invalid. You're not valid. You cannot work. You cannot be used. Or you are cured and you are reintegrated to work. And so basically, you know, you look at the whole, ontological, like the birth of the civilized hospital. You look at its use, the reason for its being, but also its parasitic relationship in today's order to illness itself, because doctors, I mean, if you are wild in the wild and you take care of yourself and your community takes care of you and you take care of your community of life, which is, again, I always stress, diverse. It's not only human. It's not only one ethnicity. It's going to be a lot, you know, a lot of these societies, they welcome, it's not by blood that you earn citizenship in their community. They do not have somebody who monopolizes the knowledge of whether you're ill or well. In a civilized society, you need an expert, someone who can measure your output in terms of labor. And if you don't have that output, then you will be, regardless of what you feel yourself or what you think yourself, you will be identified as ill. And then you will have to be recycled. So you're not the owner of your life, your happiness, and your harmony any longer. You are somebody's resource, and the doctors need, like, if there are no ill people, to be categorized as ill and cured, then there will be no need for doctors, right? So they also have this parasitic relationship to illness itself. They need that illness. They need that definition. And so, of course, the minute you have categories and groups categorized on various levels, you know, based on class, but especially in North America today, it's still so blatantly in your face based on race. That if this woman is deemed not valid for work, homeless, a burden to society, you're not going to waste your time. So empathy does not even come close to it, because we are stuck in this narrative of abuse, and it's pathological. Yes.
It also seems to be also related to the utility of a person and how they're perceived. Like, she was perceived as being, you know, of no use to anyone in our society. So basically, like you said, why waste the time to heal her, quote unquote heal, if, you know, in our society, a black person or a black woman is deemed to be very low in the totem pole, basically.
Exactly. And, you know, waste resources, waste a bed, waste time. You're going to go and and take care of someone who's going to be useful for that order. And so the whole concept itself of hospitals has to be questioned in this sense. In my dissertation, I don't remember exactly the name of the study, but there was a study. It's a medical anthropologist or psychiatrist at McGill who was talking about that. I mean, still, doctors know and doctors are aware of the fact that the best way for someone to heal and to be cured is to listen to their own body, identify, like, control their own narrative of how they feel, and find this desire and help to reintegrate. And you look at the statistics that people of color in North America are not given the possibility to create their own narrative. We constantly have to hear what the white narrative tells about us.
Right.
And so any person of color at any point having an encounter with these institutions of discipline, I call the medical sector an institution of discipline, on an equal basis as the police. And actually, Kropotkin again, in his work on prisons, says 19th century, he identifies, he's like, okay, the hospital will play the role of the prisons. So he was kind of a precursor of Michel Foucault with this panopticon that at a certain point, you don't need that violent order. And actually, he was wrong in the sense that the hospital did not replace the prison. They both live happily ever after. Well, until today, we still have them both. And both disciplines give us our narrative. And that narrative disempowers us. And it's this narrative causes us what Frantz Fanon called, you know, our pathology, the pathology of colonization of the black race, or, you know, of brown races.
Right. And what was also distressing about the Anna Brown situation is that in the video, you can see other black people watching her try to explain her situation to the doctors and the nurses and eventually the police. And maybe they were sympathetic, maybe not, but no one stepped in to help her and speak on her behalf. No one said, hey, maybe we should try to help this woman.